What signatures would this leave on cosmological observables? And in particular, can we say anything about the initial state of the photon by looking at the Nagyasha endings in the CMB spectrum today? So what I hope to convince you is that the excited initial state will indeed leave a distinct signature on the three-point function, but also that the strength of such a signal is bounded by certain consistency requirements from back reaction. And in particular, the energy density at the beginning of inflation must not be so large as to overwhelm inflation from occurring altogether. So this is the bound that will kind of guide the rest of the talk. So the plan for my talk will be as follows. I will begin with a quick review of inflation. And use it to sort of further motivate this question that we're examining. Next, I'll discuss this high Lagrangian formalism. Which is a choice of field redefinition and gauge that will be especially convenient when we discuss cosmological perturbations. I then turn to the theme of non-Gaussians. And describe how this may be used to probe the initial state of the inflaton. Then I will introduce a density matrix formalism. With which we can describe an arbitrary mixed state. And finally, I will put all the ingredients together and return to the subject of these back reaction constraints. So I'm sure all of you are familiar with the unresolved puzzles from the Hot-Big-Bang model. For example, there's the horizon problem, why the universe started out in a homogeneous electronic state. There's a flatness problem, and then there's the problem of unwanted relics, which is why, for example, there's no abundance of magnetic monopoles around us. And the theory of inflation postulates an era of exponential cosmic acceleration early on in the universe's history, and thereby solves all of these problems in a simple and elegant way. Qualitatively, what it does is to take one small causally connected region in the early universe and to blow it up to encompass the whole of the observable universe today. And in doing so, it would also redshift away any memory of curvature or unwanted relics. Now, to see what could give rise to such a mechanism, I'll start with the FRW metric from GR, which describes maximum symmetric space. Where these are moving coordinates. If we combine this metric with the Einstein field equations, assuming that the stress energy tensor is sourced by a perfect fluid, we will arrive at the Friedmann equations. A dot over A squared, also called the Hubble constant, equals 8 pi g rho minus A squared. Where rho is energy density, and also the installation is what I actually see. Row was three feet of pressure. From this original work here, we can already see that, like, so the extension will occur only if the ratio of pressure to energy density is less than -100. But we can even more specific if we want exponentially extend the universe. We can make the onsets A equal to E to the H to some constant H, such that the ratio A dot over A is exactly equal. Is exactly equal to H. So, and assuming that the curvature is sufficiently small, this tells us that energy density in such a space-time must be constant. And if we would then take into account the conservation of the stress of heat tensor, we would find that the energy density must be equal to the negative of the pressure. So the equation of state is only going to equal -1. Now, inflation is generally modeled by taking a scalar field called the inflaton, with the free field action. And also corresponding stress energy tensor. That actually looks like the stress energy tensor for perfect fluid. If we make the assumption that the energy density goes as the sum of the kinetic term and potential term, and pressure goes as the difference. So from here we can see that in order to realize the equation of state omega equals -1 requires that the potential energy of the scalar field dominates over the kinetic piece. And we could draw these equations. Where the field by the end height in some arbitrary inflation would occur so long as it's slowly growing along the potential, so that stacking energy drives inflation. And inflation comes to an end as soon as this condition is violated. This discussion here so far is completely classical, but such a field would also experience quantum fluctuations. And it turns out that these fluctuations lay the seeds for large-scale structure formation in our universe. And in order to see this, we've already seen that in an inflationary universe, the Hubble constant, and hence its reciprocal, Hubble, the Hubble radius, which sets the natural length scale and is horizon in this theory, is exactly constant. But by any physical length scale of a quantum world, say, would be stretched out during inflation, so that it will eventually exit the horizon and be out of causal contact with itself. At that point, its amplitude is frozen in, so we end up with a spectrum of kinetic perturbations on large astronomical scales. Hubble radius then increases in the subsequent matter radiation and dark energy phases, such that these worlds will eventually re-enter the horizon as observable fluctuations today. And this we can also draw graphically. So the Hubble radius is constant during inflation, increasing afterwards. And any given physical length scale, say our horizon today, uh, We have started out within the hub radius, but exited at some point during ignition, in this case, five vehicles ago. And we've re-engineered the accessible to observations at this time. By looking at this picture, we can go back and say a few more words about the motivation for the problem that we're considering. So the literature generally takes the inputon field to start out in a vacuum state. But this seems to require unreasonable fine-tuning, given that we don't know anything about the Planck scale physics that preceded the starting inflation. A common counter-argument is that the process of inflation itself should wipe out any trace of the initial state. And for a classical fluctuation, this would naively be true after suppression of, say, e to the 60th power, diluting away information, the same way that the flatness and Monaco problems are solved. But in the case of the quantum picture, because modes can exit the horizon and become frozen in, then we can imagine a situation where inflation occurs for exactly, for say, 60 or so people, it's necessary to solve the horizon problem. And then the modes that we observe today would have spent the bulk of that time outside the horizon, so that the redshift would be much less. And our goal is to make a more quantitative statement along these lines. Okay, so to this end, I'll now introduce this highly redshift formalism. With which we can then go on to analyze these density perturbations. This particular work can be found on the archive. It's work of Cornelli, Senator, and other authors. And I'll be very schematic in this presentation, kind of leaving details. So the philosophy of cosmological perturbation theory generally requires selecting a given theory, for instance, a single field inflation, and then selecting some particular potential, and expanding around that background and seeing what physics comes up. But it would be nicer to analyze all the backgrounds at once if that were somehow possible, at the cost of writing down an action that contains three parameters. So, in other words, what we want is an effective field theory for the fluctuations around some arbitrary background theory. And the approach that these authors take is to first, they pick a gauge where all the fluctuations are in the metric, in the time variable, and then they parameterize longitudinal fluctuations of the field of the inputon by introducing this auxiliary field pi, which has an orthodox transformation under time diffeomorphisms as follows. So that we can write down a manifestly different variant action in terms of variables, the derivatives of pi, and functions of pi plus t. To perform the construction more carefully, these authors actually begin by breaking time translation invariants, and then writing down the most general action that preserves spatial but not time diffeomorphisms, which, for example, would include functions of time, the 0-0 component of the metric, which transforms as a scalar under spatial dips, and the extrinsic curvature of constant time surfaces in ADM formalism. Then they restore the time symmetry at the cost of introducing this field pi in a kind of reverse Higgs mechanism. So pi is the Grossmann boson associated with spontaneously broken time symmetries. The end result of all this work that they do is that they can fill in some of the three parameters in this action. And it has this following form. Where this piece is the perturbed piece. This next piece is actually interesting because it couples the quadratic and cubic order pieces. And so on. So this is the action at cubic order, and of course there are terms of higher power that we are doing it for now. M2 and M3 are the free parameters where by filling them in, we can make this action specific to any theory of equations. And this middle piece shows that indeed the speed of sound is actually the presence of a speed of sound 90.1 actually implies the existence of a non-Gaussian inducing spectrum. So this is basically just an efficient way of encoding all the theories at once. These authors were also able to show that pi is related to the more commonly used variable zeta by field redefinition, which at first order was this one. So pi is the variable that we'll choose to describe the all fluctuations in for the rest of the song.
So does this formalism scale to multiple fields easily? There's only a single field at the moment, right?
Yeah, so you can always do this for the adiabatic. So pi naturally picks out the adiabatic direction of the field, and then you would add to that the isogonal fluctuations as well.
So I guess I'm trying to figure out, is this a real advance over the usual formulas? Or not?
So, I mean, it doesn't give you anything you wouldn't have before, but the beauty is the simplicity of the answer. This is the point is that any theory of a single field would look like that up to cubic order, and then you've encoded all that information in a small number of free functions. So there are many different theories. With a choice of potential kinetic term that would look identical up to cubic order. And so this is a kind of more economical way of encoding that information.
Okay, so having those, we can quantize economically and extending it in terms of loads and creation and dimension offers. And in fact, in a de-Sitter background, the form of the solution for these modes is known exactly. And it has the following form where epsilon is going to be the slow mode parameter. And beta is the conformal type. And having done this, we can, of course, write down the conjugate momentum to the field and derive the Hamiltonian just in the standard way. So that pretty much sums up this piece of the formalism. And now let me switch gears and go back to the subject of non-Gaussian. So in the study of cosmology, we have this indispensable tool in the form of CMD, which gives us a map of these density fluctuations at the surface of mass scattering. And we might ask, what sort of information can we extract from this map? The simplest statistic that you can imagine would be the power spectrum or two-point Gaussian, which measures the correlation between the expectation value of the correlation between two arbitrary points. And this tells us lots of information about the composition of the universe. For example, how much dark matter there is, how much dark energy, and so on. But in order to probe the interactions of quantum fields in the early universe, we really need to go to higher order statistics. And this is what's known as non-Gaussian. And the reason that we would have to do this is peer review, look at this from the quantum perspective, as the fact that this point to here could only ever code streams of two operators, but the QFT interactions are coded in the higher power chips. So, in fact, it turns out that the Fourier transform of the three-point function, also called the bispectrum, will tell us when in the universe's history these interactions have occurred. It follows from momentum conservation that a three-point function in momentum space is non-zero only if the sum of the vectors adds up to zero, so that the k's actually form a triangle. And if the vectors form an equilateral triangle, this tells us that interactions occur at the larger crescent. If the vectors form a sort of a squeeze or a local shape, interactions occur more after horizon crossing. And if they form a flattened triangle shape, this implies that the interactions would have happened near the beginning of inflation. So put another way, if we see this flattened triangle signature in the spectrum of Van-Dasch entities, it's telling us that the universe may have started out in an excited initial state. So in order to derive this result, I'm going to take another detour again and present the inequalism.
Sorry, just before you go on, can you just explain a little bit more of this flattened versus squeeze triangle? What are the differences?
So the squeeze triangle has one side is very close to the flattened triangle is just the sum of two sides is really equal to the thing. And so this is the result that I'll try to do in this visual reference. So
a squeeze is a special form of flap.
Yeah. So this is a brief digression. We are working in the interaction picture of quantum mechanics. We divide a Hamiltonian into a quadratic free part and a high order interaction part. And in particular, the state in this picture is given by the following. Now, in cosmology, we're interested in computing the expectation values of operators at a fixed time for correlation functions, which would look something like this. And if we would just plug in this definition from the interaction picture for the states, this expression is equal to where T and T bar are time ordering and anti-time ordering, respectively. Take this expression and put it in a more useful form by the Taylor extended exponentials so that at first order this expression becomes work. Suppose that we want to compute the expectation value of this three-point function, assuming the bunch is spiking. We just replace this arbitrary operator A with three copies of the field. then this term here is the vacuum expectation value of three copies of the field being equal to zero. And we can compute this term taking the interaction Hamiltonian from the Pylagorean picture. And this just amounts to doing a lot of weight contraction. And we would end up finding schematically that the three-point function in this formalism has the form when this delta function is again conservation of momentum. We get a product of nodes from the three copies of pi's. We get a product of those from the Hamiltonian select period. We get the expectation values of strings of six operators, something like this, which is a quarter unity, and then times some coefficient. But we know what these modes are, because we solved them exactly in the Jupiter universe. So if we take the solution and plug it in here, this expression becomes this integral can actually be evaluated explicitly, and doing so will just bring a factor of the sum over k's into the denominator. So a final expression for three terms that look like so. And this is all for if we had started out in the bunch data state. But if instead we start out in a different state, we could relate it to the bunch data vacuum by making a Mogolian transformation and introducing new modes. Which are linear combinations of the old ones. And if we go back here and promote all the use of these and multiply it through, then what we end up getting for our current slide, we would get a term from basically taking this piece three times, but we would also get pieces that would mix the positive and negative frequency modes. Schematically, might look something like this. And then when we do the step of plugging in the exact mode solution, what happens is that it will flip the sum over k's in the exponential into say k1 plus k2 minus k3. And carrying through the integral will then bring the minus sign into the denominator. So the end result is that if the sum of two of the ki's is very near to the third, the denominator will of course diverge and the squeeze triangle state is enhanced when the plus starts out and extends there.
Squeeze or flat?
Or flat. So, this is so true for all pure states, but we can be even more general and say something about suppose that we start out in a mixed state. To do so, I'll introduce this density matrix formalism. Now, we know that any statistical ensemble of states are can be written in terms of that's the matrix. Where the expectation values of operators in the mixed state is a trace of the density matrix times the operator. But alternatively, we could specify a mixed state fully by giving all of its moments with respect to the expectation values of strings of creation and annihilation operators, for example. But we give all these strings, it's equivalent to giving the density matrix. And this information can be further compressed into just writing down a single generating partial, which is a function of some arbitrary coefficients alpha and alpha star. That has this form. Where by taking derivatives with respect to the alphas and alpha stars, and then evaluating at alpha equal to alpha star equal to zero, we recover every one of these expectation values. For example, the expectation value of some operator, AK1, would be equal to the trace of the product with the density matrix, which is equal to, we take the derivative with respect to this alpha, it brings down a copy of this operator from the exponential, and then when we set all the alphas equal to zero, just the exponential. Now, by analogy to the ininformalism, we can write down the type evolution of the generated functional, which again will just be the commutator of the functional with the interaction on its own. In fact, these two terms will cancel out exactly once we commute the Hamiltonian past the exponential. And that's just because the trace is invariant under simple permutations. So performing this actual commutation, we can do that by writing H in terms of some coefficients times, say, the momentum cube. Replacing the momenta with the mode functions and the operators. And similarly, taking the Taylor series of the exponential, right, writing it in terms of. Something like this. Then commuting these two terms with one another is just requires using the commutation relation of A diagram sometimes. And ultimately, the end result of doing that is that any arbitrary cubic Hamiltonian, say with the following form in momentum space. Where lambda is any coefficient. The evolution equation is given by the following. Whereby the sum over the SI and the odd batch. We're summing over all possible ways of assigning stars to the alphas. So this equation here, I'll move the box around. is actually one of our key results. So what we have done is we have this formalism now where we can encode any pure state or mixed state, and this evolution equation tells us how this completely arbitrary state will evolve. And this is exact so long as the Hamiltonian is cubic. But in fact, if we had a Hamiltonian to higher orders, we could carry out this exact same procedure, and it would just be missing. But the idea is that we can come up with an evolution equation for any arbitrary state, arbitrary state that we've been described in this way. Okay, so finally we can put all these pieces together now and try to say something about the constraints from back regression. And just to restate the main question. So what we're trying to do here is to ask that given any initial excited mixed state of our choosing, what's the largest non-Gaussian entity that we could see in the universe today subject to this condition that initial state wouldn't have so much energy as to overwhelm the equation. And again, that condition is this equation up on the first board there. So using this formalism, we can begin by constructing a mixed state that will excite only the three-point function. And it will have this form where this functions B and C are arbitrary for now. Our goal is to bound them somehow by using this back regression constraint. This is indeed equal to the trace of the expectation value of the corresponding string operators. Now, as a consistency check, we can plug this state into the evolution equation here to see what comes up. And what happens is this term here will give rise to a non-zero two-point function. This term gives a four-point function, and this term gives a six-point function, even though the original state excites only a three-point function. Basically, whether it gives rise to an endpoint function, you see by just counting the number of alphas. More intuitively, we might have guessed that a state that starts out with only a three-point function, but that has a cubic interaction, would give rise to, say, the two-point function schematically through something like this. But it's nice to just have this all appear explicitly from the formalism. So one thing you might have to do by starting with this state is to ensure that any leakage from an excited state of this form into the two-point function can't be so large as to contradict observational bounds. And this is one of the things that's still work in progress that we hope to say something about in the future. So now the back reaction constraint, again, is to maximize three-point function at wait times, given this bound on the on initial times. And by taking the interaction Hamiltonian from the pie picture and putting everything together, we will come up with a really long constraint equation, where we have some overall coefficient that comes from the Hamiltonian. Uh, CS is the speed of sound times this piece that's tracing over all the combinations of the alpha and of A and A dagger. And then we multiply by a factor of unity in the form of writing the three-point function at length times using this formalism. And it just times the three-point function in the same form. And is this quantity, which must satisfy that it is less than the energy scale of inflation. This numerator here has to be evaluated at early times because that's when we fix it down. Whereas the denominator here is evaluated at late times. Because this is equal to this three-point function at length times that we just played.
So what do you mean by late times?
Late times being today.
Today?
Yeah. Early times being the starting question.
You mean after the end of the thing?
Yeah, you mean after writing.
After writing.
Okay. Because this is actually just a factor of one. This is the maximum observational signal that we want to place in this region. If we just look again at this mode solution from in the decenter space, we see that at early times, this quantity here goes as the conformal time. So that this bound is exponentially sensitive to the number of e-folds of inflation up to horizon crossing, which is as we would expect. Because if we just look at the very at the naive bound, 0, 0. The stress energy tensor we might expect to redshift as matter. To go as some constant times the scale, times the inverse of the scale factor cubed. So if the number of e folds is large, then the scale factor at initial times must have been very small, which would make this expectation value quite large, and thus make this entire bounce rather. So this is reflected in this more specific equation by the presence of copies of the conformal time in the mode functions here. Now, given a shape for the three-point function, we can replace this quantity with some shape-dependent factor times this amplitude f and l. And by solving this integral, we can then place the shape-dependent, k-dependent, and initial time-dependent constraint on the maximally observable FNL today. So now, basically, all we have to do is evaluate this integral, but there are some difficulties involved in doing it. Some maybe an iota releases that we're still trying to figure out how to get around that. But yeah, that's pretty much all I have to say.
Thanks for very nice. Any final questions?
So I guess a general question, if you could think about doing this in a classical context, which may not be very accurate, but if you could think about it. And so then in that context, the idea would be, what bounds could you put on spatial homogeneity from back reaction, and therefore what limits would you get on non-Gauss energy? Would that be the equivalent kind of classical statement to what you've been doing?
I think it's The classical would be built in because you could just take a coherent initial state. It would be like, say, some classical inhomogeneous thing. And so, yeah, the band would apply.
I guess the interesting thing is, even in the classical case, we don't actually know what the limits are, you know, before you destroy inflection.
Yeah.
Because then, of course, if you think of it in a classical context, there's immediately some sort of averaging scale. Inhomogeneity on what scale must be less than some. So I guess when you take these expectation values, there's implicit there's a scale, right? Because you're saying, you know, assume you're saying it's in some sense the state is homogeneous, statistically homogeneous, constant state. So it wouldn't be appropriate for kind of chaotic inflation, or do you think it would still be okay? I guess I'm trying to make the link to, you know.
It's going to be unknown in the case, and that's going to be the.
Yeah. I mean, when I take the expectation value in the classical sense, that's like an average, right? I'm averaging. But on what scale? Are we averaging over, you know, Hubble scale, the whole universe? In the classical case, that's up to you. But here in the quantum case, it's not clear what that expectation value really means in terms of.
So that's actually, that condition, that's sufficient for back reaction to be on your photon, but that's not necessary. You could have, have a huge expectation value of T00. It doesn't mean that you won't have inflation. Your inflation might look different, but you still might have inflation, right?
So it wouldn't be so slow at all. You would have sufficient correction to the background that we would then have to redo the calculation.
But it's still like you might still get inflation. Might be just a constant. It might just be a renormalization of the.
So the T00 has two bits, which is going to be a constant piece, which will sort of renormalize. But that's not the piece we have in mind. It's the piece. So that piece. So we have in mind the redshifting part, which is the part from actual particles. Mm-hmm. So if you think you're an excited state in the city, you'll have two contributions. You'll have the constant piece from being in Lynch Davis plus then the redshifting part.
Mm-hmm.
So we assume the constant piece has been renormalized through appropriately. And so this T00, if you like, is T00 in excited state minus Lynch Davis to subtract out those pieces.
I guess I'm trying to make a link to this, like, Guth-Vidal Vilenkin state. You have to be homogeneous on a patch bigger than the Hubble scale to start in relation.
So I think that's sort of a very similar statement for back reaction values. So you're saying, because any inhomogeneity has some energy density.
Yeah.
And so how homogeneous you need to be over the scale, over the Hubble scale, is basically imposed by.
But I mean, it's as long as I've got a homogeneous patch, it doesn't matter what's happening outside. So it can be extremely inhomogeneous on scales larger than the Hubble scale.
Absolutely.
So I'm trying to get at what is the scale that's implicit in that.
I see. Yes. So this is being imposed. You would have in mind this is only being imposed for the modes that we see today, and therefore those modes automatically have to come from sub-horizon scales. So the average is only, clearly you don't want that to impose that everywhere, you just mean that over the region in which the modes are created. So so it would be naturally averaged over the scale set by the modes that we see today would have been at that time.
Are those the relevant modes for stopping the onset of inflation? Because I would have thought, you know, the modes that would tend to destroy inflation were ones that would be much bigger than what we could see.
That's right. But those ones.
Especially because you could have 1,000 e-volts of inflation.
That's
right. Of course, you wouldn't see this. I mean.
So I guess those ones, though, you wouldn't say anything observational about them. So they can do whatever, as long as inflation's occurring.
So I guess, that now that we're getting to. Is that the constraint that's really relevant to bounding F kind of non-Gauss energy that we see? Because they're two separate sets of modes in a sense. Because
yeah,
if you had 1,000 equals of inflation,
yeah.
You know, the observational, the modes that would give Gaussianity would be irrelevant, would not have to satisfy the constraint.
But in this scenario, you cannot have 1,000 equals.
I guess
that's right.
Numbers,
yeah. Yeah, so like, yeah, so implicitly, you're working with short number of equals beyond what you need for horizon.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, presumably, Transplanckian, you could have 1,000 equals inflation and still have Transplanckian, something, do something crazy with the Transplanckian modes, right? And then still have this kind of bound, but still have this kind of calculation being valid, just you wouldn't have any constraint from the back. So to put it another way, if we observe FNL bigger than, or some appropriate number, by spectrum, bigger than the bounds you have, that wouldn't necessarily, I guess, what would that mean? Is kind of the question.
Mm. So this is probably fair to say this is a conservative.
Right. Well, it can mean two things. It can mean that inflation can still occur with that.
Or it could be transplanted.
Yeah.
So it's a good, yeah, it's a good point. So you could imagine, okay, maybe locally the stress energy could be bigger than that condition, but because the average of the whole inflationary patch is low enough, you can have inflation. But then, so that's true, but then this calculation, you're still assuming that those modes in that regime of wavelengths are evolving on the fixed background, which is averaged. But clearly that wouldn't be true because you'd have some kind of large fluctuation here. So at the very least, it would say we'd have to redo the calculation appropriately. So this is a kind of conservative, but within the limits of this calculation we're doing, it's what we would need to impose. Probably fair.
So it's really a consistency foundation for the perturbation theory.
Exactly. Yeah, and if it becomes more nonlinear, then
no. Yeah. So sorry, one last question. The flattened triangle, if we measure FNL, is there an easy way to convert from constraints on kind of FNL local, say, to flattened triangle? Not an easy question.
Then
would we put a separate constraint?
Yeah, it's done.
Things like usually FNL like constraint, like M2 maybe some one of the coefficients. It's using first comes to epsilon, but here you have M3 and CS, so then you have two other ones at the same time constraint.
No, but this. The excited states are separate from M2 and CS, those are. So they are in addition to these parameters in the action. So this alpha beta thing is in addition to M2 and CS.
So could you observe some variety, not the same for the flattened triangles, and say, it must be because of you're not in these French degrees, and all because you're in this specific. Mixed state, or can something else happen which would mimic the same thing?
Yeah, so so it's generally explained that if you start out in an excited state, then you will have leakage into the higher correlation function. That you would then, in principle, would allow you to distinguish. Whereas, so in principle, of course, you can just put in the initial condition you want to see what you get out.
But I more want to work the other way around. And again, maybe if you observe a specific understanding for some triangles, and then you look at, you were able to look at the system function, and maybe you can say, okay, it's really this. This specific non-Gaussianity arises from the mixed state or the known.
So I guess you can say, so if you see anything other than equilateral and local, then it has to be something went on before.
Okay, is that clear?
Yeah, it's clear.
Okay.
So,
Yes, I guess if you know, they have all these optimal estimators for FNR, which is a very specific time. So if it was instead of this form, I would still see something in those estimators. I might just get a bit of...
You would see a smaller signal.
Yeah, kind of, I might get inconsistent results depending on what...
That's right, yeah.
There was for people who do two transplantation for two-point function, the corrections are usually coming from older M over H or something.
H over H.
Okay. So, but the question is there going to be some correction like that?
The shape for transplantation, is that similar to this or?
Oh, well, I don't know what's.
That's
fine. Those papers are so dodgy, but yeah.
Being recorded.
I guess it's time to jump in.